Nothing is more expensive than bad information. Know the source. OneRadioNetwork.com.
Well, we're starting right on time. What a concept. Good morning, and this is Patrick Timpone. Welcome to part two of our little program that we are on Monday through Friday. Usually take Thursdays off. OneRadioNetwork.com. On the fourth Wednesday of the month, we're joined by an interesting fellow. He is a publishes the U.S. and World Early Warning Report. He was formerly global affairs editor of Money World. It was a very respected business and economic analysis in America. He's written articles in major publications around the world. He's written a whole series, maybe 12 or 13 of the Uncle Eric books. Very, very popular in the homeschooling world. And his Early Warning Report comes out 10 times a year. The July report is just out. And if you get that one, he'll walk you through some of the resource stocks and also recovery stocks that he believes is going to happen when this COVID thing. So that's in the July issue. And a very pleasant good morning in California to Richard Mayberry. Hi, Richard.
It's good to be on again, and let me thank you again for the job that you do. It's so important for people to hear some sort of alternative view to the mainstream press, and you do a great job of it, and not just your own viewpoint, but you know the guests you have on, and this is essential to the political health of the country, what's left of it. I personally thank you very much for doing a job that's extremely important.
Well, we appreciate your comments. It's an honor to talk to you. Last month, Richard Mayberry, you were talking about the idea that the economy is the people. It's not a mechanical thing. And once the COVID phenomenon dies down, that things could get back and we could really have some kind of good recovery. As you know, there's more and more testing today, right? Everywhere, Texas, Florida. And the tests are not, our research is showing, doesn't mean much of anything, but they're coming up with the idea that there's more cases. And there's actually many states that are doing more masking. Texas is one of them. More, it seems like they're going to take this corona thing possibly out for a spin and see what it'll do and extend it. Does this change your forecast of this economy thing, what we call it, coming back?
Well, I don't know about changing my forecast. I've been saying that this thing is way blown out of any realistic proportions, and it's really. In my opinion, and I explained this in the July early warning report, the really important thing that I think is out there somewhere coming in our direction and will be the turning point is when a couple of reporters, mainstream reporters from the Washington Post or the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, some really big news organization do what the Watergate reporters did with Woodward and Bernstein, where they blow the whistle on the thing, and they look at the underground stuff that's going on and paint you a picture of it's realistic. And those guys, whoever they are out there, this is going to be their chance to be really famous and really rich. And they got to be coming. There's got to be somebody out there that's working on this. And the thing that they need to focus on is that the federal government is paying people to report cases of COVID-19. They're paying hospitals to report these cases. And the operative word there is report. These hospitals do not have to prove that they have these cases. What happens is a person comes in the door at the hospital and the hospital puts down that he's sick and he's got who knows how many, maybe a dozen different possible illnesses, one of which is COVID-19. And they report that to the government. The government gives them money. And then if they put the person on a ventilator, the government gives them more money. And if they report that the person died of COVID-19, then the government gives them even more money. So they're being paid to have COVID-19 cases, and they don't have to prove that they have them. There's nobody that is doing any kind of a reliable audit of what these hospitals are reporting. And this is going on not only in the United States, but around the world. The federal government gives our tax money to hospitals around the world for reporting that they have COVID-19. They don't have to prove that they've got these COVID-19 cases. They only have to report it, and they get our tax money. So, you know, there's got to be some reporters out there in the mainstream press that are going to stumble onto this and figure out, you know, they're going to get rich from reporting this. And whenever that happens, I think the economy will turn around like pretty close to overnight. Mm-hmm. You know, businesses will throw their doors open, they'll go out and hire more people and on and on, and the recovery will be on in a really big way.
So regardless of what some of the more alternative things like our place, like you or myself and other people on YouTube, you feel our culture and our media is such that it would have to be something big like a New York Times or Wall Street Journal or, like you say, Washington Post to blow it apart, or maybe a Fox or somebody like that, or CNN.
Yeah,
right.
I think so. Yeah, mm-hmm. There's got to be someone who is prestigious among the mainstream
press.
Got
you. Yeah.
You know, because the mainstream press is still the main place where most people get their news,
mm-hmm.
And so you've got to impress those people. Even though they're mostly a bunch of socialists, they control the news media.
Yeah.
So it's only going to take one really gutsy editor and one or two reporters to make a big story out of this in, for instance, the Washington Post or the New York Times, and it'll be over with. That'll be the end of the COVID-19 crisis.
Kind of a Watergate Pentagon Papers thing.
Yeah, right. That sort of a thing, I think. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not for 1 minute saying that there is no COVID-19 illness. There is a disease like of that type. But in my opinion, there is no evidence that it indicates that it's any worse than the annual influenza. It may be a little bit worse, but not much, as far as I can tell.
We have no idea, do we?
Yeah, we really don't, because the hospitals are not paid to prove that they've got COVID-19 cases. They're only paid to report them. And in the newsletter, I point out, you know, a friend of mine was talking with a hospital nurse, and the nurse said, everything that comes in the door is labeled COVID-19.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's where they're getting their money, and these hospitals are in deep financial trouble. All of their types of surgery that produce the most money have been delayed, and they're in a lot of financial trouble, not just in the United States but around the world, and they need the money desperately. And you can look this up on the internet. You can look up the forms that the hospitals have to fill out to declare that they have a COVID-19 case. And you can read the instructions. And the instructions say nothing about proving that the person has COVID-19. It's just that, you know, if the person is suspected of having COVID-19, the hospital can report it and get money for it.
Very interesting. Richard Mayberry, Patrick Timpone. New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut have just put out an order saying that all visitors after being quarantined for 2 weeks. Wow, it feels like there's a push on to keep this going.
Oh, yeah, right. Wow. Well, you know, both the government and the mainstream press rely on fear. That is their most important asset. They have to keep people scared so that with the press, you know, so that people keep tuning in to hear the news, and with the government so that the people beg the government to have more power over them to supposedly protect them from whatever they're afraid of. You know, all governments operate that way, and the press all over the world operates that way. They both want to stir up as much fear as possible because they personally benefit from it. And I think that's most of what's going on here. They've got a good thing going. You know, people are tuning in, and people are begging for the government to be more powerful to protect them, and they're going to keep it going as long as they can.
Is this at all similar? You write so many interesting books about World War One, World War Two, the Mideast War. It's called The Rest of the Story, right? World War One, The Rest of the Story, World War Two, The Rest of the Story, The Thousand-Year War in the Mideast. Great books, and Uncle Eric books. Has this been done often in with wars the same way?
Fear? Oh my gosh. I think it's the most common way that the wars start. Because governments are inhabited, you know, governments aren't huge machines or huge bodies of super experts who know how everybody should live. They're just ordinary people like you and me, and they are power junkies. They want the ability to meddle in other people's lives. That's the kind of person a government attracts. And governments all through history have attracted that kind of person. Well, the power junkie, once he's in there, he needs an excuse to do whatever it is he wants to do to people. And so he has to keep them in fear. And war is the best way. War really produces an amazing amount of popular support for the power junkies. And one of the best examples was 9/11. It was like within weeks after 9/11 happened that the president's approval rating jumped 34 percentage points.
34%. Wow.
Yeah, and that happens pretty much in every war. Studies have been done on it by political science experts that, you know, you start a war and immediately, you know, if you're a president, you start a war, whether you do it covertly or overtly, you start a war, you get more popular. And incidentally, I think that's what we're headed for this fall. Both the U.S. president and the honcho in China, they both need a war really bad. They need to have more and more loyalty behind them because they're both in trouble politically. So I'm not saying they for sure will do it, but there's a lot of pressure on both of them to get more popular fast, and a war is the way that always works.
Well, in your July early warning report, you really talk a lot about it, folks, and you should get it and read it. But we'll go into a little bit here about China. So what's going on, in your opinion, Richard Mayberry, with China, that they're doing a lot of new different things? They're buying gold, there are a lot of technology, and they're expanding their money supply incredibly. What's their... In your opinion, what's their end game here? What do they want?
I would politely suggest that we not use the word they.
Okay.
There is the power junkies who run China.
Mm-hmm.
Just like there are power junkies in Washington that run the U.S. And then there are the people.
Right.
And they are two entirely different groups of individuals. And you know, the ones that we should be worrying about are the individuals that are actually in power, in political power, in any given country you want to name.
Mm-hmm.
The people generally do not want a war. In any country you walk into, it's that way. And incidentally, Americans are told that the whole world is out to get us, that the the whole world hates us. It is true that the whole world hates Washington. The whole world is scared to death of the U.S. government, just like any American is. I mean, you know, you get an envelope in the mail from the IRS, it scares you. Well, everybody in the world feels that way about Washington. it's everybody is scared of Washington, and so Washington has a lot of enemies all over the world. But anyhow, getting back to the China situation, the Chinese government has a really big, nasty economic situation there that's getting worse fast. What's happening is now there are Western companies that have been over there for years operating in China that are leaving now because they've figured out finally that it isn't such a great place after all to be doing business. It's so corrupt, among other things. And so you have these Western companies leaving. Well, when they leave, the jobs leave too. So the Chinese government is facing this fact that jobs are leaving China and capital is leaving China. The Chinese people themselves are trying to get their money out. So they don't talk much about it, and the mainstream press says very little about it. But there's close to, in my opinion, a panic over there to get out of China. So the Chinese government needs a way to establish more loyalty to itself so that it avoids a revolution. And let me point out, if you know anything about Chinese history, you can go back thousands of years, China is the bloodiest place on earth, by far, with the possible exception of Europe occasionally. But as a regular thing, all the way back, going, I don't know, maybe 4,000 years, something like that, China has been a place where the slaughter has been just unimaginable. And so they all know that. They know what their history is. And so that all by itself, when things get dicey in China, the whole population gets scared because they know what their history is. And I think that very possibly there's already a emergency situation, a secret emergency situation in Beijing, where the leadership is desperately looking for a way to keep a revolution from happening.
And they do that by building their points with the people by going after Taiwan or whatever mm-hmm. they're planning.
Mm-hmm. You're all right. Mm-hmm. You'll notice lately they have escalated the pressure on Taiwan,
yes, sir.
For people that don't know that part of the world, Taiwan is an island off the coast of China, and that's where the Chiang Kai-shek and his group fled to back in the 1940s and established, I guess they call it the Republic of China,
mm-hmm.
It's the island of Taiwan. And the Chinese government in Beijing has always wanted to take that island. And so they've stepped up the pressure here lately, and some of their top military people are saying openly that if the Taiwanese don't cave in peaceably, that Beijing will attack. Now, Washington, back in the 1950s, agreed to be the protection for Taiwan. And they still have that relationship with the Taiwanese, where American soldiers and sailors and airmen are committed to risking their lives to protecting Taiwan from China. This is so insane. I start talking about this, and I can't believe it. But that's the way it is. That's the way Washington behaves. It wants to be the policeman of the world. Again, they're power junkies. They like this stuff.
So this is grist for the mill for President Trump or other presidents to then push back and say, well, if you attack Taiwan, we have to protect him. That That whole thing. Wow.
Yeah, in Taiwan, I don't know what it is, 100 miles or something off the coast of China. I mean, it's over there, you know, a long, long way away from America. And the Washington has always had this promise that it's going to protect Taiwan. I mean, these days, Taiwan is within easy missile range of the whole, practically the whole coast of China. It's ridiculous. The U.S. is still promising to protect them when it's actually militarily not possible.
Richard Mayberry, Early Warning Report. It's a kind of a blend of different things under with his unique perspective of many years of geopolitics, finance, economics, and military affairs, and how debasement of the dollar moving forward with money printing by the central banks may affect your finances. In the July report, we won't go into today because we want people to get it, but you go into some resource stocks that could be doing really well with the dollar possibly going down after a while, and also some recovery stocks, right, that people, mm-hmm. once this thing blows over. So let's talk a bit about the dollar. So do you see the dollar then will get stronger and we're going to have some deflation before we see the inflationary pressures of all the central banks' money printing, which I suspect, I don't know, what do you think, Mr. Mayberry, has there been like $3 or $4 trillion so far with the corona rescue?
Yeah, I think it's in that neighborhood.
I can't believe we talk like that, like $3 or $4 trillion.
You know,
like,
right, yeah. It's really interesting to me that if you go back 10 or 15 years, the only people who ever used the word trillion were astronomers.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Wow. And now we just say $3 or $4 trillion like it's $3 or $4, right?
Yeah, right, yeah.
Jeez. How did we get here?
Yeah, well, we got here because people are trained in school to trust government. If the American founders were here, they would just be freaking out. I mean, you know, that's the one lesson that they tried to leave us, is never, never, never trust the government. Never trust any government. You know, they're all power junkies that want to control your life. So do not trust them. All the founders, unanimously, they felt that way.
That's interesting. They knew it, didn't they? Back 250 years ago. Was that why they put the line in the Declaration of Independence that from time to time you're going to have to take them over and change them out?
Yeah. Jefferson, who in my opinion is the star of the American Revolution, Jefferson said he wanted to see a revolution every 20 years. Because if you went longer than that, it would get too big to slap down. And so you had to periodically, you should put it on your calendar. Every 20 years, you have a revolution. So you keep the government small and unable to wreck your life. Obviously, you know, what happened in the actual case was that it took about 60 or 70 years for the first revolution to happen. That was the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
I think Jefferson would have approved of the Civil War in the sense that, despite what we're taught in the government-controlled schools, it wasn't about slavery. It was about slapping down the federal government. You know, the federal government had gotten too big. It was too intrusive. And the right thing or its power to be drastically reduced. And Lincoln said, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to allow the federal government to keep growing. And that's what the war was about.
Yes, that's what some people have said. Past guests, too, that's going to be coming back, a very interesting fellow, an attorney of about 60 years, and he's written on that idea that it was a banker's war. It was about, you know, and it's a section and all of that, Richard. And then also, he's going to talk about some of the misconceptions about the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence next Wednesday before July 4th weekend. So that'll be fun.
Yeah.
So check this out. So I know that you're a real military kind of, you study a lot of the military because you believe that's how you work with your newsletter to help folks to understand how to profit, if you will, from from Mars and stuff. This is an interesting article, and I thought about you when I read it. Have you heard about the, you probably have heard about it. It's called the BeeDo Satellite 3 Navigation System. 35 satellites, excuse me, a $10 billion project that's been going on since the 1990s to completely circumvent the whole, what's the thing in the car? What do they call it?
GPS.
GPS, right? They're going to have their own thing. And they've been working on it for 20 years.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about the Chinese.
The Chinese, the BeeDo or whatever it's called. Yeah. You know about this?
Yeah. Well, yeah, very little bit, not much more than you just said.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's known to be going on, which I don't know. That seems like not a bad idea to have a backup GPS system, you know, because you don't know what might go wrong with the one we use every day. So I don't know, but undoubtedly that has military applications, and undoubtedly that's Beijing's main reason for doing it.
Because I think their smartphones, excuse me, and the drones and everything work with this thing, but they want it to be, according to this article, they want it to be separate from the GPS, which is a U.S.-based system, I guess, right?
Mm-hmm.
U.S. satellites, navigation satellite system, long, wow.
Mm.
And then we see we saw some articles about in the desert of the United States and their stealth bombers doing these faux, if you can use that term, nuclear, testing these babies out.
Mm-hmm.
So militaries do that, Richard Mayberry, just to kind of flex their muscle, just to do this stuff?
Well, there's that, yeah. But you need to have a military because there's a lot of lunatics out there that want to hurt us.
Of course.
Okay.
Can I quote you on that? There's a lot of lunatics out there that want to hurt us.
Yeah. So you need a military.
Yes,
and
sir.
If you're going to have a military, there's no sense having one unless it's actually able to defend you, and that means your weapons have to be as good or better as the other guys. So you need to test your weapons to find out if they are.
Mm-hmm.
So all militaries are always testing their weapons and their troops. It's very often referred to as maneuvers. We're going to go put the troops on maneuvers.
Mm-hmm.
And when they're on maneuvers, they are testing not only the hardware and the supply lines and whatever else you can think of. They're also testing the troops themselves and their organizations, the loyalty of the troops. That's a really big thing. Not so much in America, at least not so far, but in most other countries, the politicians are scared of their military because their military can kill them very easily. And so there's always this tension in most militaries that, if we tell them what to do, what we want to do, will they do it or will they turn on us and kill us? So there's a whole lot of that goes on in every, and I shouldn't say every, in most militaries, they're about command and control, meaning will the troops be loyal? Will they do what the politicians want them to do? There's a lot of militaries that have political officers, and the political officer is a guy who's snooping around all the time trying to figure out if these troops really are going to follow orders when they're told. So there's a whole lot of psychological stuff that goes on in militaries that the public really has no understanding of. One of the most important things is the career sergeants. You always want to keep kind of an eye on the career sergeants, what they're thinking, because whenever you meet one, you want to talk with him and just figure out what he's thinking, because he's the guy who really runs the military.
Oh.
The career sergeant, he's not even an officer. He's a non-commissioned officer. But what counts when the rubber meets the road is whether Private First Class Jones is going to pull the trigger and shoot the people that the politicians want shot. And it's the sergeant who's there on the scene who decides what orders are going to be actually given to Private First Class Jones and in what Jones actually does.
Has there ever been cases where the sarge says, no, we're not doing this?
Oh, boy, you know.
Really?
I think the whole Vietnam War was
was like that? Yeah.
Yeah, and I've known several sergeants, you know, that were proud of their refusal to follow orders. If they were told to go out on patrol in Vietnam, they would, they load up, get all set to go marching out, and they'd leave the base, and they'd go off into the jungle somewhere, and they'd find some spot that looked really safe, and they'd, all their guys would hunker down, they'd hide, and they'd send back regular situation reports to the main base. They were totally made up, you know, we're in such and such a location, we're looking at such
really?
And such.
Interesting.
Yeah, and all of that was just lies, because they realized that they were being lied to by Washington, that they were risking their life for a pack of lies, and they simply wouldn't cooperate. In the My Lai Massacre, I mean, one of the greatest examples was the My Lai Massacre, not the part that the public knows about, but there was a helicopter gunship that was in the area when the village was attacked by the Americans, and the villagers were running out trying to escape from the Americans, and men, women, and children. And this helicopter pilot and his crew could see what was going on down below, and they set that helicopter down between the villagers and the American troops, and the chopper pointed its guns at the American troops and ordered them to go away and leave the villagers alone.
Really? Wow. Never heard that one.
Yeah, I mean, now that guy, I'm sure you can look him up on the internet, the pilot of that chopper. But that whole crew should have gotten medals of honor. I mean, that's the most gutsy thing. because, you know, those American troops could have just cut them to ribbons if they wanted to. But that standoff, that they had the courage to do that, to save those villagers' lives, that's an astounding thing, and you know, there should be monuments to those guys all over, because they didn't follow orders. They did the right thing.
After the Pentagon Papers and the Vietnam, were more of the military back, more of the mainstream media back then more interested in telling the truth than Walter Cronkite?
I think, if you're saying more interested...
Telling with more of the truth rather than whatever the government was telling them?
I think so, yeah, I think so.
Once it was out?
Yeah, I wouldn't know how to measure such a thing.
Sure.
But, you know, looking at the way the news media is today, as I said, you know, they're almost all socialists. They don't know they are. It's just what they were taught in college. And they honestly believe they're reporting the correct thing, that they're doing what's right.
Yes, sir. And you know, 50 years ago too, since I was in the broadcasting, Mr. Mayberry, back then you could only own, I think, six stations total, radio and TV.
Mm-hmm.
Six.
You know, I didn't know that.
Oh yeah. Now, you know, of course, you can own 140 if you want.
I did not realize.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Only six of them. This is an interesting quote before the first break. The last time the president was so outspoken was Dwight Eisenhower. And this is a quote from President Trump, and I saw the interview. He said, "Don't kid yourself. We do have a military-industrial complex. They like war," President Trump said. Wow. I wonder why. Well, no wonder maybe they... no wonder they don't like him.
Well, I would not say they like war. I'm I'm certain they like weapons,
mm-hmm.
which is not a bad thing. We need to be protected. We need to be able to protect ourselves.
Yes, sir.
But this idea that the military-industrial complex wants war, I've never met anybody in that industry
that felt that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, they really, really want to build more and better weapons. They're into that. And that's good. You need somebody like that if you don't want your family living in a concentration camp. So, yeah, that's a good thing to have. But in America, I've known an awful lot of people in uniform and in the military industries, and I've never known anybody that I thought really wanted war.
So it's an easy thing to get to kind of morph into the idea that the military-industrial complex is the problem, right, and then blame it on them.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
That's really.
So once again, you're talking about a thing, and then the people, similar to China and the Chinese people, government.
Yeah.
It's
so important to see, mm-hmm. in every country, to see the people as mm-hmm. something different than the government.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's one of my main criticisms of the mainstream media. It's probably my top criticism, is that they use the name of the country as a label for the government. China did this, Russia did that, Britain did this or
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
So that the mainstream media is painting the entire foreign population as the people who are guilty of whatever happened. They don't say that Xi Jinping did such and such. They said China did such and such. And that's a horrible thing, because the other country, that population then, believes that they are being accused of something terrible and they're going to need to protect themselves. So it's a horrible thing, and it's what it's one, the main thing that wars are made of. It causes populations to be loyal to their governments, even if they hate their governments, because the population feels like they are being accused of whatever the government is doing, and they have no other protection than their government. If I could just make the mainstream media do one thing, it would be to stop using the country name when talking about that country's government. They should be saying, the way I do it usually is I talk about the capital city. Beijing did this, Berlin did that, Moscow did the other. And the audience understands you're talking about the government when you talk that way.
Yes, sir. Richard Mayberry is with us. Stay right there, Mr. Mayberry. He's here the fourth Wednesday of the month and at 11 o'clock Central Time. And this is the kind of analysis and critical thinking you'll get with his newsletter, Early Warning Report, earlywarningreport.com. He also has a pretty cool thing that I think you might be interested in called Ethics Solution Course. And it's ethicssolutions.net, ethicssolutions.net. And this could go being a very nice thing for more and more homeschoolers because of the vaccine thing and all that. The homeschool community is really growing, and they love the Richard Mayberry Blue Stocking Press books. And they're used often in the homeschool arena. Patrick Timpone, OneRadioNetwork.com. We are going to be experimenting, doing our own little medical experiment, going into some stores, telling them that we don't want to wear a mask, and giving them a reason why and seeing how it'll work, and because we've been doing some research. So, you'll hear about it on Open Phone Friday. Hear the results of that experiment that's going to happen today. Previously with Dr. Rulin Chu about her product, called Pearlseum. So let's talk about the teeth first. Explain to me what's going on, because there's something magical when you dip your little toothbrush in water. Why do they look so sparkly and just, I don't know, something very energetically about the look of them.
Yeah, it's very, very magical. So like a group of scientists in France discovered that when you put pearl next to the bones or our skins or other connective tissues. And they find it stimulates new growth of the bones and skins and connective tissues, and also to make existing bones and the skins more healthy and stronger. So brush your teeth with the pearl, then your teeth will make your existing teeth stronger, and also it will filling up, you know, teeth with the porcium, and the pearl powder will stimulate the new bone growth and also make the existing teeth very strong.
It's really a great product. You'll love it. Take it internally or on your teeth, and you can click an order, see the ad right there, Pearlseum, the nice green container, Pearlseum, on OneRadioNetwork.com. I mentioned Jack Graham, attorney Jack Graham, and he practiced law for about 50 years, I think. He's written several books, one on the Civil War and the real causes and such. And he's going to be talking about the idea that the American Revolution, what that was about really, and he thinks it's not about what's being taught. And also the Navigation Acts of 1600 and 1663 and the Currency Acts of 1751 and 1764 and some of his opinions about these statues that are being torn down. So I think it'll be a pretty lively show. His name is Jack Graham. That's going to be July 4th special on July 1st. Remember our sulfur product that we talk about? We really like it. It's organic sulfur and it's pure. We have a sale going on, and that's going to happen through July, the end of June. So right up to July 1st, we'll have the sulfur special going on. 20% discount, so it's a good thing. You don't need a promo code or anything. It's a great product. We've been using it and experimenting with it for many, many years. Good stuff goes on. Hair, skin, and nails. Pure organic sulfur. OneRadioNetwork.com, and the sale goes on through the end of June. We're talking with Brandon Amalani about his great product, the Blue Shield. And the Blue Shield is the main product is a cube, and it doesn't block the EMFs as some people think, right, Brandon?
That's correct. It doesn't. It's really about the communication of the device and the body. And what we figured out is how to communicate with the body and amp it up. So it's affecting the cell voltage, it's affecting the intercellular communication. And the most important part is that it's getting the body to stop fighting the EMF, which are repetitive signals in the environment. They're non-native, they're man-made, and the body raises white blood cell counts and attacks it like it's a virus, essentially.
That's interesting. That's very, very different technology from most units around.
Oh yeah, absolutely. This uses multiple scalar outputs, and it's really innovative, the scalar realm, because it's using crystal photonics or light to basically do this digital signaling that creates these longitudinal waves that move through time space and affect the subatomic structures between atoms. So as it moves and passes through your body, it's literally affecting the mental, emotional, physical, and spiritual components of what we're made up of.
Well, as you can hear, this is interesting technology, very different. And working on the cells in the body. The Blue Shield, it's on our website, front page, use promo code OneRadio, little cube, take care of the whole house. They also have a little personal guy you can put in your pocket or purse. Blue Shield, promo code OneRadio, OneRadioNetwork.com.
We are listener supported, One Radio Network.
It's the fourth Wednesday of the month, 11 o'clock Central Time, brings us to Richard Mayberry, editor of Early Warning Report, earlywarningreport.com. The dollar, Mr. Mayberry, it's up pretty big today. Somebody's happy about the dollar, up almost half a point. Mm-hmm. A dollar's up, gold is down a little bit, and the market's down about 600 points or so. Oil, let's see, just kind of hanging around. Oil's down a couple dollars. The Fed came out, was it last week or the week before, saying the Federal Chairman Powell that we're going to keep these interest rates kind of like, you know, low for what, another year, did he say, through 2021? So that's curious. Talk about that. That's not good enough for savers, is it, for people saving their money?
Oh, it's catastrophic. It used to be that for almost all my life, I'm 73, and it goes way back before that, that a conservative person who did not want to get deeply into finance and make daily decisions about their money They could just put their money in a bank or in well-secured bonds of some type, and they would, you know, get a regular return. And, you know, throughout history, that kind of was around 4% or thereabouts. And, well, sometimes it ran way up beyond that and sometimes lower, but 4% is about what you could expect. So, as I point out in the early warning report this month, or in July, the if you had a savings, a nest egg of $2.5 million, then that would generate $100,000 worth of income.
Per year?
Yeah.
Okay, at 4%. Okay.
Right, at 4%.
Mm-hmm.
So, if you had $2.5 million, you're going to earn $100,000, and that would be almost no risk. And you wouldn't need to be babysitting the money. You wouldn't need to be checking on it every day and making decisions to move in and out of stuff. You just get your regular 4% and live happily ever after, which was, you know, young people don't think about that. But, boy, when you get up above, let's say, age 50, you start thinking a lot about that. And by the time you're 65, it's obsessing you. It's just the main thing in front of your face all the time is, are you going to have enough money to last for the rest of your life?
Mm-hmm.
And if you had a, you know, in today's terms, if you had the equivalent of $2.5 million, then you'd be earning $100,000. Life would be good. Now the Fed is committing to keep those interest rates almost zero.
Yes, sir.
So you can't earn anything. You might have your $2.5 million. But it's not generating hardly any income at all, which means that in order to live, if you're retired, you have to keep spending that principal. You know, you're going to have $2.5 million this year, you're going to have $2.4 next year, $2.3 next year, and you're slowly going to go broke. And you're going to be watching this happen every day. It, your principal is declining, and you're... you just live in permanent fear that your money's going to run out before your breath does.
And, of course, most people probably have a whole lot less than 2.5, right? Maybe
right.
Maybe 400,000 or 500,000 if they've really done well. Mm-hmm. And that would be a huge hit as well, right? Four times five would be, what, 20,000 a year? Or if you had 500,000, would that be a 4%? Something like that. Whatever. Four times five is 20. Yeah, I guess it'd be 20 grand, which I guess you couldn't live on unless you were in, you know, Nicaragua or something. So then if they change it to zero, is that why Richard Mayberry, most people then go ahead and jump into stocks, equities, because they think they're going to, they don't trust being in the cash because of the interest rates fluctuations?
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
What I tell people is, you know, you got to face it. Stocks are the only game left in town. There's just no other way to earn that income that you're going to need, and and that means you need a really great stockbroker. And you know, so there's a lot you need to know about picking a stockbroker. One of the main things is you want your broker to understand what's called Austrian economics. Yeah, that's the economics of Friedrich Hayek and Ludwig von Mises. Friedrich Hayek earned the Nobel Prize, and that group of economists that agree with him are called Austrian economists because most of the originators were from Austria. And that's the economic, in my opinion, the economic model that is the most realistic.
Because?
They are, for one thing, they see the economy not as a machine the way the mainstream economists do. They see it as a an ecology of biological organisms, meaning humans. And these biological organisms have free wills, and they make all sorts of decisions, and they change their minds constantly. And the Austrians recognize this. You hear about it. These mainstream economists talking about speeding up the economy or slowing it down or fine-tuning it as if they think they're working on an engine. And they're not. They're working on people, human beings, innocent human beings. And these economic policies that the government adopts, listening to these mainstream economists, are policies designed to interfere in the lives of totally innocent people. The Austrians recognize that, and they recognize that that assumption that there are experts somewhere who know how you should live your life, that that is just wrecking our civilization. And we have got to go back to the assumptions that were made in the 1800s, that were mostly those of the American founders, that you are the best controller of your life, that other people don't know you, they don't know what's good for you. You should be making the decisions about your life, not some bureaucrat in Washington.
What a concept.
Freedom, my gosh, you know, who would have ever thought?
who'd have thunk it? Oh, my God. So you're saying that you could actually find brokers that understand what you've just said, and that's who you want to take advice from? Like guys like you, or I mean, your newsletter, you give specific stock advice, and which people can do if they want to get your newsletter. But there's also stockbrokers that kind of are in tune.
There are some, yeah. A lot of them are my proteges.
Ah.
You know, they read the Uncle Eric books as they're growing up. I mean, there's the homeschooling movement is now 2.3 million people.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah.
Yeah. So there are a lot of people raising their kids according to my books, and my books teach Austrian economics. So you have a group out there now that really do have a pretty good understanding of Austrian economics, meaning they have a good understanding of things like recessions and inflation and all of this stuff where the mainstream says, well, nobody really understands. Nobody knows what's going on. The government just has to keep manipulating things because there's nothing else that can be done. Well, the people that grow up with my books realize what's really going on, that the power junkies are using their power. And that's what really essentially goes on in every country around the world now. The whole country, the whole world has been taught either socialism or a warped version of socialism, which is called Keynesianism. It's one or the other in every country. There's a few that are called monetarists, but they're pretty close to Keynesians. So you really only have two essential working models out there. One is Austrianism, and the other one is, let's call it Keynesianism or socialism. And the Keynesian or socialism always assumes that these people in Washington know better than you do about how you should live your life.
So that's Keynesianism and socialism. Would Jerome Powell's of the world, or the head of the New York Fed, or Treasury, they generally would be Keynesianist.
Yes.
Keynesian guys.
Yeah.
Wow. So if you were an Austrian guy and you had a lot of money, a rich father, and he put you in the presidency, would you be able to do anything, I mean, differently, do you think? Or is it even...
Well, if you've got enough charisma that the population, let's say 75% of the population, will be behind you, if they understand these things we're talking about, okay, then, yeah, you could pull it off. That was the wonderful thing about 1776, is that the population understood what the founders were trying to do.
Oh, they did.
Yeah, there was a huge amount of stuff written back then. The literature of the American Revolution is very rich in talk about what was called the system of natural liberty, which we today would call free markets or free enterprise. The founders I should back up a little bit. The whole American system was based on the fundamental principles of the common law. Most Americans don't have any idea what the common law is, but it was the set of legal precedents that were developed over more than 1,000 years in Europe. And they were the most well-developed in England, and then they were transported to America by the English. You know, when the Americans came, or when the British came to America, they brought common law judges with them who understood all of this. And the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, the Virginia Bill of Rights, all of these main documents in the American Revolutionary period were derived from the principles of the common law. And the typical American was very well educated. He studied the law, believe it or not. There was one general during the Revolution that was sent over and told to control those colonists, and he wrote back to his commanders in England that you can't control these colonists, they're all lawyers. That's how well the American people were steeped in common law and the common law principles, which hold that your rights come to you not from the government, but from your creator.
And whatever and those are what what you call the two laws, those 17 magical words that you brought out many years ago are based on, right?
Right. The fundamentals of common law come down to 17 words.
Give it to us. Those are great.
Okay. Yeah. Do all you have agreed to do. Now, that's the basis of contract law. And then do not encroach on other persons or their property. And that's the basis of tort law and some criminal law. If you just memorize those 17 words and try to live your life according to those 17 words, that's all, 17 words, for one thing, you're going to find your life is going to be a whole lot better, especially, and there are lots of people that do this now, especially when you make friends.
Yeah.
You evaluate, are they following these 17 words? And you want your life full of people who are following those 17 words, and you don't want people in your life who do not follow those words. I'll give them to you again. Do all you have agreed to do, and do not encroach on other persons or their property. And I've had people, you know, those are taught in the Uncle Eric books as well as in the Ethics Solutions course, and I've had people tell me that their lives were miserable. They were absolutely depressed, and they didn't know what they were going to do. And they discovered those 17 words, and they just started cultivating friendships with people who follow those 17 words and dropping people that don't. And their lives turned around, and they're happy now.
Interesting. So you could even take that, could you not, to the idea that you don't want your friends or pseudo-friends encroaching on your beliefs or your theories and let you express them and without them trying to convince you otherwise.
Yeah, right.
They're encroaching on your spiritual space, if you will.
Yeah, right. Yeah, just leave the other guy alone, you know? Let him be himself. Yeah. As long as he isn't encroaching on somebody, leave him alone.
So how many laws are in the United States? There's probably billions. You think you could just have these two laws and probably get by?
Well, that's the way it was in the beginning.
Is that right? Wow.
Yeah, right. The typical American understood those laws and followed them. That was they're the basis of the free economy that grew up right after the Revolution and just became the 1800s, the 19th century. The 19th century was a period of a miraculous economic takeoff, way better than anything else had ever been seen before or since. And it was because you had this country called America that was following those 17 words better than any other country ever did. And so, you know, we benefited from that. It was amazing how the progress that occurred in just that 100-year period due to having a population that followed those 17 words.
Then what happened to let no state make anything but gold or silver a payment of debt? What was that, Article 2 or Article 1? What happened to that one?
Well, that that's in the Constitution.
In the Constitution, right?
Right, and it says, you know, only gold and silver will be legal tender in payment of debts. So, when that was the same thing. I mean, gold had been valuable for about 6,000 years, and silver for about 2,500 years, and so people saw them as a store of value, that there would always be somebody that would take your gold or silver coin in trade for whatever you had. And that spread around the world, the reliability of being able to use gold and silver as money. And the founders wanted to keep it that way, and they wanted it to be honest, that if it said $1 on it in those days, a dollar was a word for an ounce of silver. So if the money said it was a silver certificate for $1, it meant 1 ounce. Now, that by the time of the American Revolution, that had been reduced down to, I think, about 3/4 of an ounce. But nevertheless, the principle was that this piece of paper that said a silver certificate, $1, was a receipt for something real, silver,
mm-hmm.
or gold. They were transferable, and so a piece of paper was an agreement between you and whoever issued it, that you could take your piece of paper that said silver certificate into a bank and trade it for the actual silver if you wanted to. And when I was a kid, everybody still walked around with silver coins in their pockets. And wasn't too long, before that, they also walked around with gold coins in their pockets. The actual metal itself was the money, not the little disc and all. That was just a convenient way to hold it. It was the money. The money was the metal. The word back then was specie, S-P-E-C-I-E. And that meant gold or silver metal was the money. So that was worked into the Constitution, where that gold and silver would be the money, and if a paper banknote was issued, it would be a receipt for one or the other of those metals. So when the government just starts printing these receipts like crazy, they're essentially counterfeiting. What they were doing was violating the set of words that say, do all you have agreed to do. The government didn't have enough gold or silver to back those pieces of paper that were being printed, and so it was essentially committing fraud when it was printing pieces of paper that it didn't have gold or silver for. And they printed so many of them that in the 1960s, they stopped issuing silver certificates, and they just issue now Federal Reserve notes, which are just pieces of paper that signify nothing.
And then they took the silver out of the coins at what, 64, 5, something like
yep.
that?
Yep. Yeah, 64 is when they started, and it was over with by, I think, 66.
So how was it possible then that President Nixon, while was in 71, Richard Mayberry, took the dollar off the gold standard? So they did it in 33, is that correct? You and I could no longer exchange it in 1933. But then in 71, President Nixon said people from around the world who were bringing their dollars in for gold, he said, that's over too, right?
Yep,
71.
Right.
So so was the whole thing unconstitutional, literally, from when they just started printing more dollars in gold? It was just...
Right.
Wow.
Yeah. What's interesting is the Constitution says
no state
shall make anything but gold or silver
payment
legal
debt.
Tender.
Legal, yeah.
And everybody forgets that the federal government is a state.
Oh, that's right. They are, right?
Yeah. I mean, you refer to other governments. There's the British state, the German state.
State of Israel, right?
Yeah, state of Israel. Yeah, right. Well, the federal government is a state, too.
Yeah.
So the Constitution applies to the federal government in regards to the gold and silver money, and the power junkies that were in charge just ignored it, and that's it. They just ignored it.
So there were not Federal Reserve notes prior? Were they all silver certificates early on, like in 1920 and all of that?
Yeah, actually, in the 1800s, most of the money was the coins.
Was the coins, right.
Yeah, actually, gold and silver coins. There was a couple of cases. Well, I don't know. In the Civil War, both governments, both the North and South governments, printed their own currency and then debased them tremendously. The Confederate currency was debased to the point that it became worthless, where they just printed so many of them they had no prayer of ever paying enough gold and silver to cover them.
Wow. That's amazing. So now we're just doing digits, right?
Yeah.
Did you see Jerome Powell that was on 60 Minutes, and he actually, I mean, I got the quote on Facebook. He actually admitted, you know, I think it was Scott Pelley said, "You just create the money?" And he says, "Well, yeah, we just create digits. We just create digits." He said it right on 60 Minutes. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Most of the money in the world today is just electronic pulses in computers. And they can make them in whatever number they want.
Little lights on the screen, you know. There's my bank account. Whoops.
Yep. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Oh man. So you had mentioned there's really no safe place to go. Excuse me, if I can get it out. Mm-hmm. So the only other option would be treasuries, but even those they're paying so little, even at a 6 month or a year, you're not very excited about those as well?
No, they're not the only other alternative. There are lots of other alternatives, but every investment has something wrong with it. and that's been the case all through history. There's no such thing as the perfect investment. Mm-hmm. And so what you have to have is diversification. You have some of this and some of that and some of the others. You have a broker that you work with that understands real economics and who helps you select the best mix of investments so that no matter what's happening in the economy, some of what you own is going up, even though others might be going down, and that you have more going up than down most of the time. So if you can do 5% with your mix reliably, then you're pretty much working a miracle. You probably should be more aimed at 3%. And even at that, that's hard to do.
So,
how screwed up the economy is now.
So if you had enough money to live on and you weren't looking for a yearly return, you could, I guess, theoretically dump everything into gold, thinking with central bank printing that 20 years from now or whatever, you'd probably turn out okay.
Probably.
But you can't make an interest on that, right? You can't live off of that, is what you're saying.
Right. Yeah. Now, you know, any young person, I don't hesitate to tell any young person, let's say someone below 30, that you should be accumulating the precious metals, gold, silver, platinum, and palladium. And they're all made in coins now.
Mm-hmm.
And you should be accumulating those, and they should be probably at least 10% of your portfolio, and maybe 20
mm-hmm.
or a little more, I don't know. But as you say, they don't earn any kind of income, except in the end, we hope, a capital gain. So you need other investments too, and the best place to be, the way the world is today, is in stocks, good ones. You know, that's the really big qualifier there. You've got to have somebody helping you pick really good ones.
Mm-hmm.
because who knows what kind of trouble governments are going to create, and whatever you own has to be able to sail through it.
What if there are some real forces that want to do damage to the president, and there appears to be, there are a lot are, that will smash this, the market, because, you know, people vote their pocketbooks in September, October. I mean, would your good stocks that you recommend still hang on? Would they be okay?
Yeah. There's quite a collection. I name three of them in the July early warning report.
More than three. You got a whole list of the
There's
great resource stocks and the rescue stocks. You got a whole list of both, right?
Right. There's three that are picked for the recovery,
and then, right?
And then there are nine that are picked for the inflation that I think is highly likely.
Mm-hmm.
What you want is companies that are big and long established, have experienced managements. I mean, that's the biggest thing is the management. You want your broker to check out the managers of whatever you buy, because the managers really are the company. They make all the major decisions, and if they're right, you make money, and if they're wrong, you get killed.
Look the same view that you do the countries and the president, right?
So interesting. Yeah.
See, you just get really geeky with the details there, Mr. Major. That's good.
there you are. You want really high quality companies that are likely to do well in the face of whatever the government throws at them. Isn't this, you and I do, we get into the depth of things so much more than almost any other interviewer I ever work with. And it's amazing to me when we're talking like this that you never hear this anywhere else. Nobody else gets into this kind of depth, especially anybody in the mainstream news media. But what you got to understand, and what I hope you and I are getting across to the audience, is your biggest enemy is the federal government, at least inside the United States. Those people don't know what they're doing. They are experts at getting elected, not at running the place after they're in.
They don't know what they're doing.
I mean, that's a truism that people have so much trouble grasping, that a successful politician is a person who is an expert at getting elected. That's his specialty. That's what he does really, really well. If you ask him, what are you going to do about the economy, or what are you going to do about international relations or anything else, he'll know a little bit about it. He can sound good when he's talking in the microphone to the audience, but he really doesn't know anything other than how to get elected.
So finally, Mr. Mayberry, do you think that it's going to matter in November whether we have a Trump or Biden president?
Oh, yeah.
Do you think it will?
Yeah. Trump has no known ideology. But
good for him.
Right. Because if he had picked one up, it undoubtedly would have been Keynesianism, among other things.
Sure. Yeah.
Or worse, would be socialism. He does, though, have experience and a lot of business experience. So he has opinions extracted from his anecdotal experience, that's a big thing. There's no doubt. Experience is great stuff. Unfortunately, he doesn't have it plugged into any kind of a system, so he can't use it for anything other than anecdotal situations that are similar to the ones he's experienced. He can't go outside his own experience. He just doesn't have a model to take him any place from there. Because of his experience, we've seen him already in the United States. He lowered taxes and he's lowered regulations. And, you know, both of those things, among other things, are movements in the direction of the system of liberty, which is wonderful. And I applaud everything he's done along those lines. Now, his trade war with other governments, that's a bad thing. But all things considered, he's probably done more good economic things than any president since, I don't know, maybe Jefferson.
Is that right?
Yeah, right. When I really get to thinking about it.
Interesting. So, I keep saying the final question, but you're so fun to talk to. But how do you balance out the, say, a Chinese fellow who's making, say, $1, $2 a day, and there's no health insurance, and there's no fooey, hooey, and chewy, and the government protecting them, and pollution controls? How do you balance that out with then making things and competing in this country? Do you just buy your stuff from there because it's cheaper? I mean, how does it work? How can you do it without tariffs, I'm wondering?
Well, if that situation arises, it generally doesn't last long. And we saw this in China back, let's say, to 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
When they really decided they were going to open up and trade with the rest of the world, they realized they had to make something really high quality, or else they weren't going to sell it. So they did, and that's how they pretty much became the manufacturer to the world of practically everything, is by making very high quality. But they've got a tyrannical government, and the tyrannical government, instead of going in the direction of a free market, started monkeying around with the system. And one of the ways they monkeyed around with the system is by teaching the Chinese that it's a good thing to use, planned obsolescence. And the Chinese manufacturers really picked up on that. It was along about 2008 or so where the government actually made it public policy to use planned obsolescence.
Interesting.
And and so, as you and I'm sure everybody that's listening to us knows, the quality of Chinese goods has been plunging. And, I mean, you can't buy anything that's made in China anymore that doesn't break down a day after the warranty runs out. They believe that's their only obligation, is just to fulfill the written warranty. And if that written warranty says that your new motorcycle has a 90-day guarantee on it, then it's going to break down in 91 days.
It happens all the time. Wow.
Yeah.
I've heard about the planned obsolescence. You know, I've even noticed where we've got a real kind of issue, health issue, with the LED bulbs that they're promoting. I don't like them, and they have a blue light at night. Don't get me started. But then even the incandescent bulbs that you can get at Home Depot, and there's very few left, these things seem to be going out very, very quickly. I don't know if it's my imagination, but all of a sudden, 2 months after you put them in, it's like, poof, they're gone. So I guess you can engineer anything to go like razor blades, right? You just engineer it like that.
Absolutely. My wife and I talk all the time. When we buy something and we can't find it made in America or Germany or Switzerland or somewhere, and we have to take something made in China, we better buy two because one of them are going to break down.
Okay. So the trade thing will just, it'll balance itself out. So if they're making things that are not breaking, it's okay, and then let somebody in Wisconsin make something else, is what you're saying?
Well, what will happen, and what you saw happen in Japan, they went through the same thing.
Yes, they did.
Back in the 1950s, made in Japan would cause people to laugh.
Right.
It was everything made in Japan was pretty junky, but then they learned their lesson, and they started making good stuff. And now the Japanese are one of the richest countries in the world. And that's what happens. You know, once these people who are making a dollar a day realize they've got to make really good quality stuff, then people start buying their stuff and their wages go up and they become middle class and they're not cheap labor anymore. So the problem solves itself. It doesn't solve itself overnight. You can't do it all in 1 week, but that's the evolutionary process that goes on. Is once they realize they can't sell it unless the quality is good, then they start making more money and their incomes go up and their wages go up and so on. I would like to point out one thing I do not understand about Trump, it just steams me, is that there's no reason for a trade war. All he has to do is get up in front of the cameras with an array of Chinese products behind him and pick them up and say, you know, this broke down in 10 days, and then pick up another one and say, this broke down in 15 days, and so on, and just make people aware that the Chinese factories now are churning out trash. And I think that's all he has to do, is just make that well known in America. It's not your imagination. They are deliberately making this stuff to fall apart. That's all he has to do. He doesn't need a trade war. Just tell people, you know, you're wasting your money if it's made in China.
So if you're a free market guy, you are a free market guy. And you just, yes, you don't get to pick and choose.
Uh-huh, right.
That's, I'm a free market, but maybe not so much. Wow. That's interesting. Like you say, I guess the president could do a lot if they have the eloquence and the communication skills to really pull it off, right?
Right, yeah. I don't think he'd have to do very many speeches doing that kind of a presentation. What would happen is he would make it cultural that when you buy something made in China, you're a sucker. and which is the truth, you know. It would get hold of the population very quickly because it's the truth. The Chinese manufacturers are doing that to us. So why doesn't he just say so?
Why, indeed? Is it made whole America, made in America thing, you think going to make a comeback?
I sure hope so. And I mean, it's trying to. I meet so many people that walk into, let's say, a hardware store and ask her, you know, do you have a Phillips head screwdriver that's made in America?
Do they? Oh, cool.
Yeah, right. I know lots of people like that. My wife and I do it all the time, and the clerks pretty much expect it. They, you know, in a lot of, I don't know, the hardware store that I shop in, they generally know what's made in China and what's not because people ask them.
Let me ask you, what's your opinion? So in a free market guy like you are, how do you approach, say, an Amazon that, you know, what they're doing, and this guy, you know, they're $1 trillion company, and or Home Depot that makes the hardware, doesn't make it, but the little hardware store guy just can compete in that. So with that, you just let it go, and that's capitalism. It's going to wash itself out without trying to control it.
Well, it's going to, you know, this is an argument that started early in the 20th century, and when people were realizing stores were getting bigger, when the department stores were invented, really, Macy's and Gimbel's and
Sears,
you know, all of those. Yeah, gee, we're putting the little guy out of business. Well, one thing that happens is the little guy doesn't go out of business. He specializes. He finds out that he can get by very well if he specializes in. I mean, there are stores that sell barbecue equipment, nothing but barbecue equipment. So you can go into a big place and you can find three pieces of barbecue equipment to choose from, or you can go to this little guy who's got 24. And that's what saves the little guy, is his ability to be a specialist who really, really knows the product and who has a really wide variety. Now, as far as what you do about Amazon, all I can say there is that as long as they are providing goods that the customer wants and are good quality at a good price, then, you know, what's wrong with that? Now, what I think people object to is that there are some real hassles. Like, for instance, with Amazon, if you didn't get what you thought you should, you got to go to the trouble of putting it back in a box and taking it off somewhere and shipping it back to them. And you can hardly ever talk to some human being. So there are prices that are levied on you that you may not quite be aware you're paying, but you are paying for that kind of low price that they offer. And that's essentially what, as far as I know, what all of them do. They're just offering a lower price for a given product. But as I say, there are other prices besides the monetary price that you can wind up paying. And I think that, interesting point along these lines. My wife and I have come to the point where we avoid Amazon like the plague, and we buy from Walmart because the price is not going to be a lot higher than Amazon, and if the product is no good, which it often is because it's from China, we just only have to go to Walmart to take it back. We just walk in the store and take the thing back, and their return policy is very, very liberal. And while we're there, we can pick up other things we need. So Walmart benefits from this excellent return policy, from this convenient. And I think that Walmart is a good investment for that reason, that they are coming up, slamming up against Amazon, and they've got something Amazon can't offer, which is a brick-and-mortar return system.
Mm-hmm. Which people like, right?
Yeah.
And then the money goes to Arkansas, or, well, anyway.
Well, there you go, yeah.
keep it in the States, right? Keep it in Arkansas.
Right.
Mr. Maryberry, it's an honor to talk to you. What fun. We had a good time, and the July issue is just coming out of Early Warning Report. If you'd like to get one, get on board. Yeah, I think it's well worth the dollars that you exchange, and they are Federal Reserve notes, such as they are, that you exchange, so what the heck. Earlywarningreport.com. Also, remember, ethicssolutions.net. Give that a little plug, what that's about, before we go.
Well, in all my decades of doing this kind of work, I've come to the conclusion that civilization is in decline yet again. It happens all the time, all through history. Civilizations go away, and I think ours is in the process of declining because people are no longer familiar with those 17 words we talked about. And so what Ethics Solutions is about, I should point out, there was a day until the 1960s when children in school were routinely taught how to think ethically, the ethical system of thought that was extracted from the old common law. Kids were taught that, especially in McGuffey's readers, which became outlawed in the 1960s. Public schools cannot teach ethics anymore, because they see it as having been derived from religion, and they can't teach anything about religion. It doesn't have to be, and our course teaches it in a way where it's extracted not from religion but from the old common law. And so, you know, there isn't any kind of a religious connection to it in our course. The purpose of the course is to try to reestablish the student's ability to think in a systematic, ethical way, which is, it may sound complicated, but it's not. It's very easy, just like the 17 words. Mm-hmm. What could be easier than that?
Mm-hmm.
And what the course does is show you how to apply those laws in your daily decisions with your employer or your friends or whoever, you know. Just to live day to day by those 17 words the way the original Americans did, because they understood this system. I want to revive the system. And we're trying to make a meme out of the 17 words.
The meme, yeah. So it's kind of the idea of world peace begins at home. So you just do what you can in your own life, huh?
Yeah, that's right. And it, and the beauty of it is you don't have to sacrifice anything. You don't have to become some sort of a crusader and join some big movement. The 17 words, once you learn how to reason with them, they instantly begin making your life better.
It's kind of like saying to your wife, I'm going to take out the garbage. And she says, well, you told me you were going to take out the garbage. You got to do what you're going to agree to do.
Exactly. Exactly.
Exactly.
I would be willing to bet a lot of money that 95% of all marital problems would go away if people would just read our handbook.
Just do what you agreed to do.
Right.
Okay. All right, sir. Well, you have a happy 4th of July, and we will see you at the end of July on One Radio Network, and it's earlywarningreport.com. Mr. Mayberry, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Patrick. You're doing a great job, and I appreciate it.
Well, it's our pleasure, sir. See you soon. Mm-hmm. Richard Mayberry, what fun, huh? Yeah, I got his new July issue 3, 4, 5 days ago. It's really cool. He's got a whole thing in there where he has some stocks that he's going to recommend for the resource stocks that you could be into potentially, if you'd like, for when the real inflation comes on and these resources could go up. Also has some stocks on the recovery stocks once the whole COVID thing will fall down, go boom, and we'll see when that is. So kind of fun, early warning report, well worth the money. So I'm going to take a day off here. We had a nice busy week. We have a good lineup for you next week on One Radio Network. Yeah, good lineup we got. And then I'll see you on Open Phone Friday. So I'm going to visit the HEB and also Costco and see if I can make them an offer to allow me to come in without a mask. I'll report back on Friday and let you know how it went. I love you all very much. Thanks for being here. May the blessings be.
We are listener supported. One Radio Network.